We are Radio Catskill.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. Thank you so much for being here with us this evening. I'm your host, Jason Dole. But not for long. I'm about to hand things over to Bill Williams, because it's time once again for the Kingfisher Project, Information Against Addiction, only here on Radio Catskill's local edition.
Welcome to the Kingfisher Project, information and awareness about the heroin and opiate epidemic. I'm Julie Pizzol. The Kingfisher Project began in memory of my daughter, Rebecca Jean Pizzol, who was shot and killed due to her heroin addiction. At her memorial service, her former teacher, Mr. Okazalik, read an essay she wrote. It was about a bird, an injured kingfisher bird that she found and rescued when everyone else had given up on the bird. In that spirit, our community came together and formed the Kingfisher Project. Since 2014, we have been raising awareness about the drug and opiate crisis in our listening area and around the country, right here on Radio Catskill. Here is Bill Williams.
My guests this evening are Lindsay Volo and Robin Oster from the Partnership to End Addiction. Lindsay Volo is the Vice President of Health Law and Policy, and Robin Oster is the Associate Director of Health Law and Policy. The Partnership to End Addiction is a national nonprofit organization working to transform how our nation addresses addiction. Lindsay and Robin lead the policy work at the Partnership to End Addiction and will be providing a recap of federal policies related to substance use and addiction over the last 4 years under the Biden administration. We'll conclude with a look at what we might expect policy to look like in the coming years. Lindsay, Robin, welcome to the Kingfisher Project.
Thanks for having us, Bill. It's great to be here.
Yeah, great to be here.
What brought each of you to the partnership?
That's a great question. So I joined almost 10 years ago, which is sort of hard to believe now.
And it wasn't, wasn't even the partnership then, was it?
It wasn't. It was a few name changes ago. It was when I joined, it was the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse, or CASA. And I have a background in insurance and had an interest in how to use insurance to really promote access to affordable health care. And so at the time, CASA was really looking for someone to lead their work around insurance coverage. They had just done a huge report called the Addiction Medicine Report, where they had really looked at how addiction has always, one of the major problems with treating addiction is that it was treated outside of the mainstream healthcare system, and that addiction is a disease. It needs to be treated under the purview of the healthcare system, like other chronic illnesses. And the main funding mechanism for that is insurance coverage. And so I was really brought in to help lead work around policy research on insurance coverage as it relates to substance use treatment. And then as the organization has grown, we've now, Robin and I now lead all of the policy work related to all of the organization's various priorities. So one is increasing access to quality treatment that is affordable, as well as prevention, and then how we can engage and support families who are impacted by addiction.
How about you, Robin?
I came about 3 years later, so I've been here for 7 years. And I came in really just, you know, with sort of an interest in health and social policy more broadly, and came in to help with that policy work. And yeah, have been working with Lindsay since on all of those priorities that she mentioned.
What was the Biden administration's general approach to substance use and addiction in the last 4 years?
Biden really identified the opioid crisis as a main priority pretty early in his administration. In his first State of the Union, he outlined a unity agenda, and the opioid crisis was one of four pillar issues as part of that. And so overall, as part of that priority, the administration really embraced a public health approach, so focused on prevention, harm reduction, treatment, recovery, and those types of approaches. And really notably in there, they were supportive of harm reduction efforts. And that was sort of a big first for this administration. And they did also take some supply side efforts, interdiction, addressing drug trafficking, and those sorts of things as well. So a mixed approach there.
When you say harm reduction, what made that significant, that adopting that approach? That was a change. What made it so significant, in your opinion, at least?
I think there were a few things that made it really significant. I think one was that, you know, just sort of talking about it and including it in all of the administration's strategies for addressing the addiction and overdose crisis, and just sort of raising it up. I think that alone was sort of a big shift, in just showing general support for these types of things. So whether that's, you know, naloxone or fentanyl or xylazine test strips or syringe exchange programs or things like that, just sort of legitimizing those and making them a real option for people who need them. And then also really big was providing funding for these services. Those sorts of services are traditionally excluded from a lot of federal funding. So a lot of grants and things can't be used for those historically. And so the Biden administration was really the first to open some of that funding up and incorporate it as a main part of their response.
Yeah, harm reduction has a long history of being very stigmatized. So it's really not something that was embraced or really talked about at the federal level. And as Robin said, there were some really stigmatized policies restricting funding for a lot of these initiatives, really, you know, based on this belief that harm reduction encourages drug use or somehow like removes a deterrent. And I think, you know, a lot of research has shown that not to be true. And also given sort of the magnitude of this crisis, you know, when Biden came into office, overdoses have been very high and were climbing, just given a very deadly drug supply due to fentanyl, which is a synthetic opioid that was responsible for a large number of overdoses. And so there's really an incredible urgency to adopt harm reduction practices in order to keep people alive and reduce the risk for fatal overdoses, given the nature of this crisis.
Was there any resistance to harm reduction because harm reduction evolved out of the AIDS epidemic?
I think, you know, it's interesting because we kind of use harm reduction all the time. Like wearing a seatbelt is harm reduction, right? And putting on sunscreen is harm reduction. And so there's just certain types of, you know, I think there's really this belief, I think with the AIDS epidemic, with, you know, contraception or safe sex practices, there's this belief that if you reduce the risk of danger, that will encourage people to engage in the activity. And I think the same has sort of happened with drug use. It's like, well, you know, if we reduce the risk of someone dying from drugs, then that will make them more likely to use drugs. And that just ignores like a lot of the very complicated and varied reasons that people use drugs. And so it's not really something that has been borne out or held up by the research, but it's often a sort of reasoning that people will use that, again, like adopting this practice will in some way encourage people to engage in these behaviors.
Overall, what were the biggest actions taken during the Biden administration to address addiction and overdose crisis, or the biggest or what you might deem the most important?
Yeah, so I think definitely the harm reduction piece is one big aspect of it. But I think beyond that, there are a few other things. I think the administration removed some restrictions on addiction treatment. So both for buprenorphine and methadone, which are medications to treat opioid use disorder, and then also for contingency management, which is used to treat stimulant use disorder. So those were some pretty big changes there. And then also just providing a ton of funding for mental health and addiction services, as well as some of the social determinants that sort of surround it that can often be, you know, risk and protective factors for addiction. And then in addition to some of those regulatory changes around treatment, also really expanding insurance coverage and parity protection so that people could more easily access that treatment. I think those were some of the biggest.
Robin, you said a ton of funding.
Yeah, not a precise amount. Billions of dollars.
Sufficient funding?
Still not sufficient. It was, you know, more than has been provided in the past, but for a crisis of this level, and for, you know, really what's needed is like a pretty vast overhaul of this whole system, it was not sufficient for that, for sure.
Okay, I'm not trying to catch you up. I want to make sure people understand that this is a problem we still need to be addressing head on.
Oh, we are still vastly underinvesting in this problem. You know, this is a problem. The opioid crisis alone, Robin, not to put you on the spot for a statistic, but what is the economic impact estimates for the opioid crisis alone for 1 year?
I think it was like
1.5 trillion.
Yeah, I think it was 1.5 trillion in 2020.
In 2020, we're talking trillions of dollars. And that's the cost of like not addressing this crisis. So we are not putting nearly as much money into this as we're spending on the impact of this crisis in terms of lives lost, healthcare costs, criminal justice costs. This is a huge economic problem, and it is not being nearly matched with the level of funding necessary to address this type of problem.
Money which could be recouped by saving lives and rehab so that people have jobs and are paying taxes and actually contributing to the system.
Yeah. And of course, you can't put a number on, you know, the number of lives that have been lost and the number of families that have been impacted. That is, you know, there's no way to attach a number to that. It's been absolutely devastating to millions of families across the country. And so we need to be doing a lot more.
All right. Given some of the biggest actions taken and money spent, let's go down a list here. Prevention, in terms of the resources and the money that's been put into it, how successful were things?
Yeah, so I think that's like a big problem with prevention is that it takes a while to sort of know how effective a lot of that was. So we won't see the outcomes of the prevention that the Biden administration supported for years to come. But I think that there were certainly some things that the administration supported that we know are effective prevention generally. So the American Rescue Plan Act provided funding for school-based mental health services and a lot of the social determinants of health that I mentioned before are often those underlying factors that can contribute to addiction. And so even those things that aren't necessarily like super connected to addiction in their own right, they really can have a strong protective effect.
I'll just add here, Bill, because we've been doing a lot of work on sort of rethinking substance use prevention. We actually put out our organization put out a white paper a few years ago, sort of thinking about the framework for prevention as starting much earlier in the lifespan, because research has shown that the roots of risk and protection for substance use are planted very, very early in the lifespan. And we've kind of been thinking about substance use as like, you know, education assemblies in adolescence, but it's really much broader, and it really involves, you know, addressing family stress and, you know, things like poverty and childcare and sort of like these really big issues that are actually really important and have, you know, a very profound impact very early on in life. And so when a lot of the COVID relief bills address some of these really big factors. A lot of them were temporary, they've since expired, but we were really working at that time to really try to tie the two crises together, right? Like the opioid crisis and the COVID and the pandemic, and how a lot of the pandemic responses would really have an impact on substance use over time, even though that wasn't sort of one of the articulated you know, reasons for those interventions. And so that's something we really still try to create a lot of awareness about is how broad substance use prevention is and how it encompasses a lot of things. The good thing about substance use prevention is the same strategies and risk and protective factors that prevent substance use prevent other negative outcomes, right? Like mental health problems, bullying, violence, school dropout. And so it's really about promoting like health and wellness among kids. And so, you know, these strategies really investing very young, you know, has a tremendous payoff, not only for substance use, but other risks. And that's something we've really been trying to raise awareness about. I think, you know, as far as prevention goes, you asked about funding. The prevention we've seen over time, while federal investment in funding has gone up for treatment, it has stayed relatively flat for prevention. And even throughout the COVID, I'm sorry, throughout the opioid crisis, there's been a lot of focus on harm reduction, on like things like naloxone. There's been a lot of focus on treatment. There's been much less of a conversation around prevention. And it's, I think it's really important that we stay focused on prevention so that we can not only resolve this crisis, but prevent another crisis of this magnitude from happening again.
I hear you talking about the diseases of despair.
Yes. Yeah. And things like adverse childhood experiences. And, you know, they're all very, all of the, there's so much connection, right, between a lot of these things. Iceland has this like very cool prevention program that they adopted in the 90s to address underage drinking. And it's a very like, it's, you know, there's a lot of components to it. But one of the things they did was to increase access to recreational activities, give kids something to do, right? Like keep them busy, provide sports, provide yoga, provide rock climbing, like match kids' different interests. And they saw that together with other interventions, they saw their rates of drinking come way down, underage drinking. And I think, you know, in this country, sometimes when there's like budgets get tight, it's like the first thing that gets cut is the sports program or the arts program without thinking about the impact that these types of programs really have, and especially in preventing, you know, other types of risks later. So I think, you know, it's really expanding how we think about substance use prevention.
You're listening to the Kingfisher Project on the Local Edition. I'm Bill Williams. After the break, more with my guests, Lindsay Follow and Robin Oster. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You know, Trump knows that the American economy is extremely powerful, and he likes to have that leverage to hold over other countries, and he also just really likes tariffs. I think we could also get into a situation where he might have to deploy them, you know, just to show everyone that he is willing to do that.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
I'm Puthar Grace, KG, and I'll be beginning my Black History Month segments during the month of February to get into some history, then and now. So check me out Tuesday, 7 to 9, on The Music Emporium. Till then, please remember that if Radio Catskill isn't on your radio really isn't on. Peace.
Welcome back to the Kingfisher Project on the Local Edition. I'm your host, Bill Williams, and I'm talking with Lindsay Volo and Robin Oster of the Partnership to End Addiction about federal drug policy under the Biden administration. What about treatment? What were they able to accomplish, or what was the administration able to accomplish in the way of treatment? And again, I'm sure we're talking about dollars.
In terms of dollars, I have an actual number for this one. So the Biden administration invested $82.4 billion in treatment, which was 40.6% more than the previous administration. So a big increase. But as we said, still insufficient. There's still only like a quarter of people who need substance use treatment are getting it. So obviously there's still a big gap there. But then I think some of the impacts that the administration had on treatment was actually beyond the funding piece and more the regulatory piece. They made some big changes to rules surrounding treatment that have the potential to really increase access. So one was that they eliminated the buprenorphine waiver. So that was providers had to obtain a special waiver to prescribe buprenorphine. And that was something that doesn't exist for other medications, but for this medication to treat opioid use disorder, they had to. And so that was a pretty small bucket of providers who had that. So eliminating that allowed, you know, anyone who prescribes controlled substances can now prescribe buprenorphine. So that's a 15-fold increase in the number of providers who are eligible. We haven't actually seen that really translate into an increase in the number of people getting treatment yet. So that really like signifies that there are still other barriers. One of which potentially is education for these prescribers. You know, if healthcare providers don't know about substance use disorder or how to treat it. They're not likely to do so. But so the same law that eliminated the waiver requirement also required prescribers to undergo 8 hours of training on addiction. And they often, prior to this, didn't receive any training. So that is also a positive development and another one where we haven't necessarily seen the outcomes from that yet, but hopefully going forward, that will really expand the workforce and help people access care more easily.
And symbolically, it's really important. Like 8 hours of training is, again, it's not enough, but it's symbolically important that I think it's an important step in integrating addiction treatment with the mainstream healthcare system. I mentioned earlier, you know, our predecessor organization had done this big report and really found that healthcare providers are just not trained in substance use or addiction. It's not part of the training that they receive. They don't know what to do, even though this is a highly prevalent disease. They're encountering patients with it all the time. But they, you know, they're not equipped or trained. And so this is a really important step, although like more needs to be done. And I think, you know, as Robin was kind of speaking to why we haven't seen this huge increase in providers obtaining the buprenorphine waiver, it's because they still maybe like lack comfort, right, and clarity in how to prescribe the medications or just treat this population. They don't feel equipped. And reimbursement is another issue. But I think this training piece was really critical to sort of having addiction move more into the healthcare system.
Part of the problem being that medical schools, there's very little in the curriculum about addiction treatment to begin with.
Exactly. Exactly.
Did Congress pass any important laws in this in that 4-year period during the Biden administration?
So I think the most recent Congress, the 118, so 2023 to 2024, didn't pass a ton on this issue. They passed a few related bills, but mostly related to, you know, interdiction rather than prevention or harm reduction or treatment or those sorts of things. But the Congress during the first 2 years of the Biden administration did pass a few important things. So one was the American Rescue Plan Act, which we mentioned earlier. So that was really big for funding. It provided a lot of funding for mental health and substance use disorder services and some of those underlying factors. And then the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act also provided like a record amount of funding for school-based mental health services. And then there were sort of a lot of different bills focused on expanding access to treatment that were all rolled into the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2023, which is basically just the big funding bill that came at the end of that year. A lot of policies were rolled up into that.
Underneath all of this was the awareness, or certainly in the press, that Hunter Biden had his own problems with addiction. How much do you think that affected public reaction to positive results?
Yeah, on a policy level, you know, I don't know. I did think that on a sort of a messaging issue, there was a lot of focus on, I think, the impact of addiction on families. I remember like the New York Times did a big, you know, piece on sort of asking for people to share about, you know, families and their experience, really looking at the experience of family members. I think, you know, a lot of that trial, there was a focus, a lot of the, it's very stigmatizing. Like a lot of, you know, of sort of talking about sensational parts of his story. And, you know, I think there were ways in which it was sometimes used in a sort of to convey addiction in a very stigmatized way. But what was interesting that was coming through to me was sort of talking about the impact that it has on families and what families go through as our loved one is struggling, which I think is really important because we still are not really utilizing families to their full potential. Families play a really important role in every part of prevention and treatment and recovery and supporting their loved one, but they're often not given the correct information. They're often actually, you know, they're stigmatized and blamed and shamed. And when they go online, they find, you know, frankly, bad information about what to do to help their loved one. And so I think it's really important that, and I think we're still, you know, there's still not enough focus. And so that's an area where we need to continue to do a lot of work at the policy level, at just the cultural level, and certainly for funding. There's very little funding to support families. But I do think that was one thing that kind of came through to me while that was going on.
If there's been a theme while we've been talking, I've heard, and I hope our audience has heard, a number of times about summoning political will. What can we do to help strengthen or summon political will?
Yeah, I think, you know, speaking up, contacting your representatives, whether they be your federal representatives, your state, your local, you know, this is not this is not just a federal issue. This requires the support of every level of government. And I think, you know, people can advocate in a very formal way of, you know, for certain legislation or policies or bills, but also just sharing your story. This is how this happened to my family. This is how I was impacted. I think is really, really important. And I think that's something that many years ago, policymakers weren't hearing those stories from people. Families and individuals were not coming forward because of the stigma around addiction. And while we continue to speak out, that really does a lot to combat the stigma that is still continues to be very pervasive. And so I think speaking up and you know, telling your policymakers, like, this is an issue that we really care about. And it needs to be, you know, remain a priority, or it needs to be prioritized.
And I think, as Lindsay said, you can do that at, you know, the local level, the state level, the federal level, and just sharing your story or talking about it generally as an issue that needs to be addressed are all super helpful. But if people want like a more concrete way or don't really know what to say or what to talk about, like, we on our website will have action alerts, which are pre-written letters to Congress, so only at the federal level. But so people can look at the different bills that are currently introduced on this topic and just fill out a form basically with their name and their address, and the letter will go directly to their members of Congress. So we don't have any yet. So for right now, definitely the action is just to, you know, generally share your story or ask for this to be a priority. But going forward, if people want to advocate on specific federal bills, they can do that through us.
And we have an advocacy toolkit too, in which we talk about different ways that specifically written for families and how families can advocate, again, from sharing your story to, you know, meeting with your member of Congress. There's all different ways to be involved.
And remind us again, one last time, if you please, where would you find that stuff on the partnership website?
Yes, which is drugfree.org. To find our advocacy page, you can go to get involved and then advocate for change. And you'll find the advocacy toolkit, and that's where we will have the action alerts once they come out. And then I will share this year, at drugfree.org/insurance, we created an insurance resource center. So we have several tools and resources there about how to navigate insurance and what to do if you're denied care and different resources that folks can use.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
That's all we have time for today on the Kingfisher Project. My guests have been Lindsay Vuolo and Robin Oster of the Partnership to End Addiction. And it's been an informative and most helpful conversation about federal drug policy. Thank you for joining me, Lindsay and Robin.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Williams. Thank you so much for listening tonight. There's more to my interview with Lindsay and Robin. Hear our full conversation on the Kingfisher Project podcast at wjffradio.org. You can also find past interviews with great guests, authors, advocates, policymakers, and those in recovery. All up now at wjffradio.org. And be sure to join me right here next month for a new edition of the Kingfisher Project, Information Against Addiction, right here on the local edition, only on Radio Catskill.
Big thanks to Bill Williams for doing the Kingfisher Project. Thank you for listening. Do keep on listening on air Always live streaming at WJFFradio.org, which is where you can go to hear the rest of that conversation on the Kingfisher podcast. This has been the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. I'll be back tomorrow evening to do it all over again. Coming up at 7, we've got Music Emporium with Mr. Kusar Grace. But first, it's The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeffersonville Bake Shop, open every day of the week for breakfast, lunch, and after-school snacks. Also featuring olive oil, ceramics, and other handmade items by artisan makers in Palestine.